The following is a KMOX sports special.
Our city, our spirit.
Welcome to the City Spotlight.
It's in! City goal!
Now, your host, Jen Cease, on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Welcome into the downtown studios of KMOX Radio on 1120 AM, 104.1 FM. I'm Jen Cease, and I'll be your host for the one-hour edition of the City Spotlight this week. Kyle Sixta is next to me on the controls, and I appreciate his help this evening for, you know, what feels honestly like a slow soccer week when it comes to pro soccer here in St. Louis City, having the week off, 10 days off, in fact, after their last game. We'll talk about that, of course, the afternoon game on Saturday against the LA Galaxy at home, where we had a draw, of course. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But the guys, we just actually got media availability for usually on Sundays, Mondays, we get what we can go to as far as practice times and when we can get our player interviews and those kinds of things like that, so we can have them for you for our respective shows. And there really is nothing until Friday. The guys are off. And you know, assuming that media press release reads like it is, the guys are off for a good solid 4 or 5 days when they get back in action on Friday, which probably means really good rest time for those that are coming off of congested schedules themselves, filling in for players that are injured, of course, the injured themselves, getting them back to full recovery. And it's nice also as a soccer player myself back in the day to have really good rest days for those heavy, heavy legs playing, especially coming off the May time. So a little bit of slow week in terms of covering City, but we'll have more for you after Friday, of course. And then as we get into the next week where City plays on Wednesday, it'll be a midweek match, be a busy match, and we'll talk about why that is coming up. So St. Louis City SC now with one win, one loss, and one tie under the leadership of caretaker head coach David Critchley. We are now officially a little bit more, I think, than halfway through the season and still number 14 in the Western Conference. We're just a point, in fact, behind rival club Sporting KC with a record of 3-9-6. So, you know, David Critchley can't turn it around all around at one time. And I think he's making good strides in certain things that we got to see in the game, those things that he's working on with the team in training, got to see him have some success and trying to snatch up points where you can. And though a tie is 2 points off of that win that City certainly needs, there was a lot to celebrate from the game. Joao Klaus, in fact, breaking his spotty scoring record in good fashion. His first was from that 35th minute. That ball came from Celio Pompeu, who controlled the ball from the air, did a really nice kind of cut down pass, if you will, from the air to Joao Klaus for a give and go with Marcel Hartl, and then the Klaus finish.
Middle top of the box, Zaka catches up to it before Cello. Loops it out to Pompeu, axes it down, feeds Klaus. Now Cello top of the box, inserts, Klaus, he shoots, he scores!
Through the wickets of Mijovic, in front of the north end, Joao Klaus, City leads!
That call and all these calls, of course, from play-by-play broadcaster on Y98, Joey Zanaboni. It was really great to see Klaus clinically finish that, really put that just straight down on the ground. Something he's been working on, making sure he makes the most of that moment. What I really liked, too, in up to that moment, even when the chances weren't landed per se, you saw a few from Hartl to Becher, Hartl to other people, was really enjoyed seeing Cello getting more involved in the attack. Do know that from the under the coaching of Olaf Melberg, it was a more conservative approach. He played back a little bit more and knew that when he got forward, he had those responsibilities on defense. Still has those responsibilities, of course, but with Coach Critchley basically saying, we trust you. Go forward if you feel the need to go forward. Play free. Get involved, and we as a team will back you up. And you saw Marcel Hartl, Simon Becher, and Joao Klaus. I saw many times when it came to that tip of the spear, when you think of the 4-2-3-1 that they ran, so did LA Galaxy. You often saw that tip of the spear, so to speak, rotate. Sometimes it was Klaus most of the time. Sometimes Hartl was up higher. Sometimes Becher was up higher. And it was a nice rotation between them and making sure that one was higher. And when that person was higher, the other two were back supporting in those roles. So that was great to see a lot of that stuff that they've been working on in training translate to the game. Now, the first of two City leads, you heard Joey Zanaboni say City leads. That lead was lost within 6 minutes from LA Galaxy's Gabriel Peck just before halftime. Royce got into the box. He brought the ball down to the end line, as you should.
should put it back on the six. And then LA Galaxy was able to level the score heading into the locker rooms. The teams were tied. But then City jumped on it right away, just about 2 minutes or so into the second half at the 47th minute. Marcel Hartl and Célio Pompeu really combining efforts to win the ball in the midfield. And then Célio saw something that I don't think the rest of us saw, and that was Joao Klaus in on the break.
Oh, Pompeu out of our end, sending one over the top, bouncing forward, Klaus, right foot, oh baby, into the top shelf, Joao Klaus, City leads!
Really nice receive, touch, and shot by Klaus in the upper near 90, giving the South End supporter section a real treat. You know what, when you look back also on that shot too, you have to look at the fact that Klaus knew exactly what he was doing. He had an idea of where he was going, and he did a double take. He checked to make sure what was open and where the goalkeeper was. So that's something that I'm sure he and David Critchley were working on. However, unfortunately, once again, the Galaxy leveled the score, just this time just within 4 minutes. Then a goal again at 87 to take a lead with that back pass, unfortunately, from Joey Zielinski to an unprepared Jaden Reed that was picked off by Gabriel Peck. City now chasing the game in stoppage time. They managed to salvage a point with the help of a big ball distribution from Roman Berkey.
Berkey bullets it forward, header by Bob Grundle, that's all close! Oh, I don't believe it! Hits it into the upper 90 across the face and goal to tie it 3-3, stoppage time, second half! The throw-in hats on the field at Energizer Park! The first hat-trick in team history!
Joao Klaus has taken a lot of flack in recent months for not clinically finishing. Well, there is nothing more clinical than what he just did. Ball across, big ball off the head of City, into there for the one-touch volley into the upper left 90. You do it no more clinically than that.
Yeah, for sure. I was so happy to fill in for Dale Schilly. Missed Dale, of course, where normally like his analysis on Y98. He's out with St. Louis City Academy duty. He's in Nashville. They've been dealing with a lot of weather delays. He was supposed to be able to join the show here at this time, but unfortunately cannot due to games moving around. St. Louis City Academy doing well, but he is otherwise obligated. I did reach out to them and to him and just say, what'd you think about the, you know, looking at the game? And I will give you his text to me. He said, you know, grip it and rip it worked this time. I'm sure that's something that Dave Critchley worked with Joao Klaus on, just getting back to basics. It doesn't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to look superbly technical. We don't need a teaching video off this. Just hit it and hit it hard and get it in the back of the net. And if Klaus is playing free, I agree with Dale, then he's really free of that internal pressure he has on himself. Then he can likely do what he did versus LA to other teams. Keep the pressure off of Klaus, keep him backed up by the rest of the team, and just let him do what Klaus does. And in fact, that was his first hat trick in team history, as Joey Zanaboni said, from that team of the match day, player of the match day, and right now is in the running for goal of the match day. So go vote on MLS on Twitter X if you haven't done that already. Other standout names, we just heard him in the highlights. Marcel Hartl, he was in the three pregame things to look for, and Célio Pompeu being part of that ball winning and distribution. And then, of course, we can't forget Roman Berkey, not with just his ability to make his crazy saves, which he was called on to do several times, but Critchley really being sure that the team uses him in the attack, to attack from the back, to use his distribution. And boy, did he put that ball on Timo Baumgartel's head, who made sure that went to Joao Klaus, who at the weirdest angle, as Dale says, gripped it and ripped it and put it in the upper left 90. Team now, of course, on a 10-day break, some solid days off for the team. And with that, what that does, you know, coming back together and getting ready for the next match will be the focus for them this week. That next match, home is a home next week, Wednesday, not this week, next week, June 25th, back at Energizer Park for a midweek match against Orlando. Eastern Conference people will face there. 7:30 p.m. kickoff, pregame on our sister station, Y98. At 7 p.m. So we'll get a few more thoughts, of course, on City, but we're also going to switch gears and talk a little bit about the U.S. men's national team. In fact, at City's next game on Wednesday the 25th, the club will take the match, take time at the match to honor the 1950 U.S. men's national team that historically beat England. It's the 75th anniversary of that match, and blend some history with current events with former national team player Ty Keogh. Ty's up next on KMOX.
Now, back to the City Spotlight.
Our city! Our spirit!
Once again, Jen Cease on KMOX.
We are moving on with the City Spotlight here on KMOX. I'm Jen Cease, and joining me now is Ty Keough, St. Louis native, former U.S. men's national team player, soccer broadcaster. You don't know soccer if you don't know Ty. Ty, thanks for joining the show tonight.
Jen, it's great to be here, as always.
Well, first of all, I know we want to switch into U.S. men's national team, but I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity for your analysis skills. Just to quickly give me what you think about what's going on with City so far. David Critchley at the helm, three games, a win, a loss, and a tie. You can't turn the ship overnight, of course. Do you think things are heading in the right direction?
Well, I'm encouraged because it seems like with Critchley, they're taking a more attacking-minded approach, especially in terms of his selections for the first 11. You know, when you see both Klaus and Betcher out there, with Pompeo and Hartel, it's like, hey, these guys are going to go get after it, and they're actually going to pressure the opponent's back line. So that's great to see. It is, as far as how much time will it take to really turn things around? Well, you don't have much time, do you?
No.
I mean, essentially, you got to put together a string of three-point victories. And I was looking at the schedule, you know, fairly closely a little while ago, and after this game against Orlando, which is a week from Wednesday, you've got five consecutive games against Western Division opponents, and that's where you can make some ground. So I'm encouraged, really, by how that lines up in terms of having a schedule where you can get after the teams that are right above you.
And of course, City also has to figure out how to, in those highlights that I played in the first segment, it's been a It was there sometimes under Bradley Carnell as well, so it's not like it's a new thing. But City has to figure out how not to bleed a goal right after scoring.
Yeah, it's almost like a mental block. How do you focus entirely on? There's a saying that the first 5 minutes of a match or the last 5 minutes of a match, but also the first two or three minutes after you've scored is just critical in terms of. It's almost like playing tennis. If you've broken your opponent, you got to back up that break, and that's really what it comes down to. And it's a mentality almost more than anything else. Obviously, there are some very, very talented opponents, so no matter how focused you are, they could break you down. But it just seems to happen too much the way you described it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the next match then, because you mentioned that. We've got a little bit of time. It's not this week. City's got a week off to kind of rest, get things back together. They're going to come back together to train starting on Friday to prepare for the Wednesday match against Orlando, Eastern Conference foe. But we'll also be celebrating the 75th anniversary of the U.S. men's national team of historically beating England with, quote, five guys from the Hill in St. Louis. You're going to be there. I'm sure City's got you really busy with some interviews and things talking about that match. What are you most looking forward to, Ty?
Well, a very, very proud moment, of course, for St. Louis soccer and for those five guys, including my dad, who went down to Brazil in 1950 and beat what was considered to be the top team in the world, England. They were considered to be the kings of football. They had a professional league for more than 60 years already, a full-time professional league, when they faced the U.S. at the World Cup in Brazil in 1950. The U.S. team, they were part-time players, basically amateurs and guys that had jobs on the side. And it was a miracle on grass, basically. And it just was incredible to just conceive of the fact that these guys went in. Frank Borgi, instrumental in the victory, just his ability in goal. And I think England hit woodwork at least twice, but Borgi made some incredible stops. And the way my dad described it is Borgi was just impeccable, getting off his line and grabbing crosses, which were destined for the foreheads of the attacking players of England. And that is what really determined the game, with Frank Borgi's ability to come off the line, come out, grab crosses, and hold them. And Gino Pariani did his part in terms of possession in the midfield for the U.S. team. Pee Wee Wallace, always a quick winger and always dangerous in a counterattack. And Charlie Colombo, who apparently made the key tackle of the match, and it was described as a football-style shoestring tackle. and outside the box, and Borgi made the save on the free kick, or they would not have, you know, been able to go in with the victory very, very late in the game. So, you know, it's a thing of mythological proportions. It's been recorded in a Hollywood movie, Gerard Butler starring as Frank Borgi. And you know what? And I'm going to just correct you a little bit, Jen. There were four guys from the Hill. There's been a couple releases put out that I've tried to make sure they eradicate and correct them. But my dad was from the Carondelet area. South St. Louis. And maybe they think he's an Italian because, well, he lifeguarded at Marquette Park. Got kind of dark. And also because I ended up playing for the Emo's Pizza National Junior Champion team in 1975 with Guarino, with Bono, with Cacciatore,
yeah,
with a bunch of Italian guys, and a lot of people thought I was an Italian guy too. So both my dad and me, you know, have to shake that and just say, "Wait a minute, we're Southsiders, but we're not from the Hill."
Yeah, good. Thanks for the correction. But if I'm the Hill, I'm going to claim you. I'd be super proud of that.
It's a great place. Yeah, I have so many friends there, and you know, my dad's basically Irish American, so yeah, he's not from the Hill.
There you go. So I have to ask you this. It's funny. A couple things you said in there. Of course, miracle on grass. It's nice to hear about grass when you know so many times you have so many players in the youth game, especially playing on turf, which is great.
Right.
You don't get your games canceled, but and of course, guys who had part-time jobs, like you didn't do this for a living. You didn't have the equipment on you that measures every breath you take and your oxygen levels and all those things that is turned into such sports science, which is interesting. But here's what it makes me wonder. Back then, you might possibly have had no shade, of course, to the players of the time, but I remember not getting quite as much. I look at my kids playing and I'm like, they're technically probably superior to the player I was playing. But I wonder if they had the same grit and they had the same desire to win, because many times when you have those challenges, you know, the U.S. men's national team going up against a Goliath of England, you had to just want it more. Is something like that what's missing from the U.S. men's national team right now, with all the struggles, losing to Switzerland, their four-game losing streak before, of course, Trinidad and Tobago, and just kind of the current, everybody's not quite happy with what's happening with the team right now. Is that what it is?
Well, it was a different world. I mean, the guys that beat England in 1950 had grown up in the Depression. They had been through World War II. Some of them were World War II veterans, including Frank Borgi and Pee Wee Wallace, for sure, were involved in combat. Those guys, it was a grittier time. And they were just proud and competitive guys. I think nowadays, when you look at the U.S. team, and there's so many distractions because there's social media.
Yeah.
I don't want to badmouth agents, but players' agents, I think, really get in the middle of a lot of stuff that maybe wouldn't happen otherwise. Now, yeah, they're looking out for their players. They're trying to seek an advantage for them financially and even career-wise. But it's another really huge distraction when you're trying to mold a team that is focused and that can get a true goal taken care of. And there's pressure because essentially the U.S. is hosting this World Cup a year from now.
Right.
So you're expected to put on a good performance. You're expected to advance in the tournament. And it gets tough. And it goes back to something I remember, the 94 World Cup. Carlos Parreira, the Brazilian manager, confiscated every player's cell phone for 6 weeks. Leading up to the World Cup and during the World Cup.
That was back in the flip phone days, I'm sure.
Yeah. he told them, you have one job. Brazil had not, at that time, won a World Cup in 24 years.
Wow.
And is to bring the World Cup back to Brazil, and they did in 94. So, you got to be focused. You got to be gritty, just like you said.
Is there enough time? Last question, I promise, and I'll let you go, Ty. Is there enough time for the U.S. men's national team to turn it around and make a good showing when the world is watching in so little a time from now?
Yeah, there's enough time. There's almost too many options. I mean, there's so many really gifted players now in the player pool who are having good performances and good careers in top level clubs around the world, especially in Europe. So, you know, it makes it a bit of a Rubik's Cube to find the right fit of players and a system. And Pochettino, he's got his work cut out for him. The thing that he has working against him, other than the pressure of being essentially the main host country, is really to have competitive games rather than friendlies, because, you know, you automatic qualifier when you're a host. So, you know, that makes it harder to really find out what you have and what's working well.
All right. Thanks, Ty. I thank you for this time tonight. And of course, I look forward to seeing you at the game on the 25th as the 1950 U.S. men's national team receives their honor. And we kind of hearken back to those great days of when it could be done when nobody thought it could.
Yeah, it'll be a big celebration. I look forward to it. Thanks, Jen.
You got it. That was Ty Keogh, St. Louis native, former U.S. men's national team player and lauded soccer broadcaster. You can catch him at the next City game along with others as we look back to those times and honoring the team, not only with the jersey, of course, that the club rolled out this year, but looking at those players who are involved and can talk about those times in St. Louis soccer in terms of the U.S. men's national team. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of this break. St. Louis soccer and men's Mr. Soccer himself, Bill McDermott, is going to come on and talk a little bit more and pick up the conversation and get his thoughts about the U.S. men's national team. More next on KMOX. On with the City Spotlight, I'm Jen Cease, and joining me now is Mr. Soccer himself, Bill McDermott. Bill, thanks for joining me this evening.
Sure, Jen. How you been?
Good, good. Soccer seems to never sleep, although it's a little asleep for City this week, so that's probably good for the team. So let's switch our talk then to the U.S. men's national team, and I really would like to pick up where Ty Keogh and I left off. And that was really just kind of, you know, we talked, of course, about the U.S. men's national team, the state of what it was back for the 1950 team beating England, and what that really meant for, you know, the U.S. being part-time guys doing this thing. And now we've moved to the professional side where these are full-time jobs. These are often all high-paying jobs, and players on the pro levels and or the international levels. And I guess it begs the question of what do you think right now? There's probably no one answer. Is the state of the U.S. men's national team, and how does Poch turn it around in what seems like it's far away, but also feels like it's very close in the World Cup being hosted by the United States?
No, oh, it's tremendously close, Jen. June 11th was the one-year anniversary of it about to happen. The way I would describe the United States national team right now is a team that is dramatically in flux. And what is happening lately is that Mauricio Pochettino has said, I'm trying to get a balance between my presumed first 11 and the players I'm using now to see if I have any feel if any of them can really participate in a World Cup. I've been doing some calculations, Jen, and I've looked at this overall team. You're going to be able to take 26 players to the World Cup next year, and they're pretty much all assigned and spoken for. Normally, you wouldn't be able to know that right now, but it seems to be. Now, when you take a look at this current crop, I think only very few are capable of playing in a World Cup and have shown that they're capable of playing in a World Cup. Maybe Malik Tillman and, of course, Diego Luna. Otherwise, yeah. I think they are set in their first 11 going into the World Cup. And more important, I think they're really set in almost the 26 occupants on the current team. So it's a matter of preparing for this World Cup as quickly and dramatically as you can. This is going to happen very fast. But this year, Jen, in the United States is the epicenter of the sport in the world, in particular because of both happening at the same time, the Gold Cup, the CONCACAF Gold Cup, but in particular, FIFA's Club World Cup. Now, the reason for that happening in 2025, it's a dress rehearsal for the World Cup in 2026, how the committee is going to organize things, work things out with some of the existing venues that are going to be used for the World Cup next year. But this team going to be a host in the World Cup is a dramatic difference. This is going to be one of the biggest sporting events in the history of mankind, literally, because it's shifting to 48 nations
right.
from the usual 32. 104 games, tri-hosted by three countries, but the United States has to make their mark in this World Cup. Because of those players that I talked about a moment ago, in particular, we all know the names Pulisic, Weah, Adams, Musa, McKennie, Reyna, as I said, Diego Luna, Robinson. And I think I want to make a remark about Tim Ream. If Tim Ream is not going to be used in the World Cup next year, then Mauricio Pochettino is doing him an immense disservice by using him in these warm-up games, even making him captain of one of them. He should be used, and he should be one of the final 26.
Well, you know, you mentioned, I agree with you there. You mentioned Pulisic, you know, being a name, and it's interesting because I pulled up an article that just, I believe, came from today, actually maybe yesterday, from off ESPN. I can't see who wrote it right now, but just talked a little bit about Pulisic and Pochettino basically saying, hey, players need to listen and stick with the plan. You cannot dictate when you want to play, where you want to play. It comes from this article that looks like Christian Pulisic wanted to play in the friendly but didn't want to play in the Gold Cup. And Poch said, that's not how it works here. Is that some of it, too? Is that there is, you know, Ty talked about distractions. Last week, Mike Sorber talked about lack of identity. Is it all of those things where we just don't have that sole focus on playing for country and pride?
I totally agree with that, Jen. Yes. And as a matter of fact, the overall thing, this may be coach speak, but a lot of coaches will tell you, trust the overall process. You remember that years ago when Jurgen Klinsmann was the national team coach and Landon Donovan got into it with Jurgen Klinsmann with reference to not wanting to play for the national team at certain stages of his career. And you're saying that to a coach who places playing for the national team, Jurgen Klinsmann, as a sanctity to put on Germany's white, black, white. You are privileged to do that. It is a privilege. It's not a foregone conclusion because you play well for your club, you're going to get to the national team. But a lot is made about this team, this current team, going into the World Cup, being the golden generation. Mm-hmm. The golden generation for the United States national team, I think, was at the 2002 World Cup. Just remember that team, Jen, down the spine, Friedel and Gold, Berhalter and Pope in the back, Reyna and John O'Brien, who largely goes unforgotten in the United States history of national team players, and then Brian McBride and Landon Donovan at top. I don't know if this team, we will see, because they're playing literally all over the world, I don't know if this current team has that same pedigree.
Well, I really appreciate, Mr. Soccer, your time this evening kind of previewing that. Of course, more conversations to come up as the U.S. men's national team continues to go on, of course, in the Gold Cup. They did beat Trinidad and Tobago, able to, you know, they should beat that game, so you should win that game. But I guess it probably does help to break a losing streak, and hopefully that Pochettino can work with the players and make sure, you know, priorities in order in these next couple of years so you can make a good showing for your home country on your home soil.
Positively, Jen, you're hosting the world's largest sporting event. Everyone thought when it came to the United States in 1994, everybody was a naysayer. How can the United States host a World Cup? They don't have an organized league. They have no identity. Nothing they've done in the World Cup is of any consequence other than 1930 when they came in third place. And then they haven't qualified since 1950. Well, it turns out to be the highest average attendance in the history of the event. 68,991. And with the venues that are going to be used in 2026, all of which are football venues, the average will go well over 68,000 people. So this is going to be an immense event. And as we pointed it out when we first began our conversation, it's coming around June 11th next year when Mexico begins the World Cup with a game at Azteca Stadium.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Look forward to more talks and see you at the next game when City honors
yes,
the U.S. men's national team 1950 team beating England.
Yes, ma'am. June 29th, 1950. 10,151 people. Very scant crowd. United States 1, England nothing. Who would have thought this possible? But it did indeed happen.
Thanks, Bill. Talk to you soon.
All right, Jen. Bye now.
That was Bill McDermott, Mr. Soccer, talking about the current state of the U.S. men's national team. You'll catch him and Ty Keogh and others at City's next game as they honor that 1950 team and talking U.S. men's national soccer at our next home game. Stay right here. One more segment to go, and we talk college soccer because it's recruiting time. Wendy Dillinger from the Missouri Rush Soccer Club will join us to give us a little perspective and talk about college recruiting next on KMOX.
Now, back to the City Spotlight.
Our city! Our spirit!
Once again, Jen Cease on KMOX.
Last segment of the City Spotlight, and we go college soccer. We go college recruiting. You know, earlier this month, you may have remembered that the U.S. Women's National Team visited Energizer Park for a friendly. We got a chance to visit with a few of the players after the match, and I snuck in a question with Naomi Girma. She's really considered the best women's defensive player probably in the world, and just asked her about if she remembers those days of coming into college recruiting and if she had any wisdom on that.
I mean, I would say just trust the process and trust yourself and the work you put in, and hopefully, you know, you can go where you want. And yeah, I think also if it doesn't come right away, it doesn't mean it's not going to come at all. So just be patient too.
Wise words, easier said than done, I'm sure. Yesterday, June 15th, became official recruiting day for rising high school juniors. They could be contacted officially by colleges and given offers or at least express interest officially. Joining me now to break it all down, Wendy Dillinger, former D1 soccer coach and player herself. She's girls director at the Missouri Rush Soccer Club and a parent of kids who've been through or are going through the recruiting process. Wendy, thanks for your time this evening on a day where I'm sure yesterday it's just not done yet for the recruiting process.
That is absolutely true. Yesterday was just the beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, in giving us perspective for those that are going to go through it or in it right now, things have changed so much. Do you have any, you work with players that go through this, any words of wisdom on fielding the calls as players and considering all the options? And then even what if you didn't get called? What if you didn't get that particular call that you wanted to yesterday, and how you go through this process of stressful trying to figure out where you're going to go?
Definitely stress, different sides of the coin. If you're getting lots of calls, take your time, do your homework. Don't feel pressured. If the coach really wants you, they want you to feel good about your decision. They're going to give you some time to explore it. If you're not getting as many calls as you had hoped or didn't get any calls at all, be patient, keep reaching out, and also expand your search. Be open to all the possibilities at various levels. D1 is not the only experience that can be incredible. D2, D3 also have great programs and offer great experiences. Some of my best time in all of my college coaching and playing was at WashU, which is a high-level D3 program, and at UMSL, which is D2. So you got to give those options looks as well.
Yeah, and that really speaks to, right, the importance of fit. You know, you can look at a D1 program, might be one of the top 10 in the country or whatever that might be, and it looks good, but it may not fit you in terms of, do you want to play right away? Do you want to wait 2 years to get on the pitch and you're just practicing really? What are some of those considerations, and maybe even, you know, off the pitch considerations that you would encourage players to look at when they're making their overall decision?
Well, you're exactly right. You want to have an opportunity to play right away. Those are questions to ask when you're in the process. How's the campus feel? How about location, distance from home, academic programs? Do they have what you want to study? Because if you go in and you have a major injury that knocks you out for a year, or worse yet, your career, you really need to enjoy where you're going to be and thrive. The experience in the 4 or 5 years as an athlete isn't just about the sport. It's also about setting you up for life. So you need to make sure it's a balance and it's checking all the boxes for what you're looking for in that experience.
Yeah. Is there a particular, when you've gone through this with players, you know, any regret, like typical regrets players have or their parents, or things they wish they would have done? Or on the flip side, something that they asked about and anticipated very well?
You know, I think sometimes a player or a family can get so set on one specific school. And no matter what, that's where they want to be. And I think that is a little short-sighted. Sometimes it works out, but sometimes it doesn't. With a transfer portal, obviously you can look at other options and make different decisions, but it's still hard to transfer. My thought process is explore a variety of options so that you know for sure. You may think you know, but until you've done a comparison with some other opportunities, you really don't know.
Yeah. And too, I think in knowing some players who are of this age, I think it they're not necessarily at this point right now, but at some point there will become rejection. And whether you are, the offer is no longer there for you, and or you're a 16-year-old who's maybe giving a rejection for the first time to an adult, do you have any advice for classy doing that, where you don't burn bridges, but you do have your boundaries and you make your selection that works best for you?
Absolutely. You always want to be respectful in the process, and understanding that, you know, you're gonna also reject some schools. They're gonna reject you. You just be respectful in the process and always respond. I think that's the most professional thing you can do, is always respond, always be courteous and thankful for the opportunity that the coach has given you.
That's a great point. Wendy, thanks for your time tonight. Hope to talk to you again soon, because the college recruiting process has just begun.
It has. Thank you.
Thanks. That was Wendy Dillinger. She's a former D1 soccer player and coach herself. She's a girls director at Missouri Rush Soccer Club and parent of the kids who've been through the recruiting process. And she works with kids on a daily, you know, yearly basis, actually, on helping them choose the right colleges. Definitely wise words to listen to. That'll do it for the City Spotlight. It's been a busy show. I can't believe this hour is practically up. Thanks to Kyle Sixta on the controls here. If you missed any part of the City Spotlight, you can always find it free on the Odyssey apps under the podcast section. You can catch show replays. You can catch replays of some of the city game pieces that we have, like player interviews and more. The next week, MLS regular season game is home Energizer Park. It's a midweek match against Orlando on Wednesday, June 25th, kickoff at 7:30 p.m. And we'll have pregame on Wine 98 at 7. I'm Jen Cease, and you've been listening to the City Spotlight on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.